life when her mafia lover, Don Stompanato, was stabbed to death by her 14-year-old daughter, Cheryl, in one of Hollywood's most sensational scandals.
It's on the life and times of a legend of the silver screen.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Today, we are hitting the glitz and the glam and the tragedy that is Hollywood. Specifically, the life and times of one Lana Turner and her many loves and her life and her daughter, Cheryl, whose story is perhaps the most tragic of all in this scenario. But let's start at the beginning. Lana's young life essentially began with the murder, and then a few decades later, her daughter's life would be marred with a horrific murder at the teen's own hands. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So who was Lana Turner? What's her backstory? Well, Lana Turner was born Julia Jean Frances Turner on February 8, 1921 in Wallace, Idaho. She was from a working class family, but one also littered with petty crime. She idolized her dad, who spoiled his little girl in the short 9 years she got to spend with him. Her dad, Virgil M. Turner, was known to be a con man, a sometime bootlegger, an avid gambler. Her mom was a nightclub singer and hairstylist. One night, after hitting it big on a private card game, her dad left with a loot of money and was subsequently beaten to death and left for dead, propped against a building, almost like he was a drunk just sleeping it off, until it was discovered that he was actually brutally and fatally beaten to death. After his murder, Lana ended up in a foster home because her mom struggled to make ends meet on her own. And this was a time when parents struggled to support their kids, they would temporarily send them to a foster home until they got on their feet. She remembers that her parents couldn't support her at this time, and she remembers her dad very fondly. He had saved up to buy her a bike for Christmas, and that was a big deal back then. So things were pretty good before that huge underground gambling win that resulted in his death. And that was exactly what happened to Lana after her father was killed. His murder also was never solved. So she goes to a foster home. After her dad is killed, his murder is never solved. And when Lana and her mom reunite, her mom decides they are going to hit the road. In a mud-covered, barely functioning car, they head south for Hollywood. Now, sources for this episode are a Vanity Fair article by Hadley Hall Mears, a Mental Floss article, Lana's own carefully crafted biography filled with stories about her need for love and her daydreaming about the perfect love and life called Lana, the Lady, the Legend, the Truth. And then there's Detour, a Hollywood story written by her daughter, Cheryl, whose heartbreaking but eventually triumphant account of her life will be quoted a lot in this episode. In Cheryl's book, she is honest but kind when it comes to her mother, Lana, and the situation Cheryl found herself in by way of her glamorous but challenged in the love department mother. I mean, Lana was almost childlike. I think that might be the kind of the best way to describe her, but Lana describes her mom still as glamorous, and she was never intentionally cruel to someone. Yes, she had many love affairs, but Cheryl also remembers her childhood as being very idyllic, minus the very big tragedies we're going to go into. So let's get back to Lana and her mother heading to Los Angeles. So they hit the road after her father's murder. They head to Los Angeles. On the way, they get in a horrible car crash. The car flips. And along with the help of some locals of the town they were passing through, they all flip the car back over and keep driving south for Hollywood. These two, thick as thieves, mother and daughter duo, were tougher than most men. They'd already been through the murder of Lana's dad, and their life would seamlessly blend into the next generation, with Lana and her daughter, Cheryl, being thick as thieves, enduring tragedy after tragedy. So they moved to Hollywood, where Lana attends Hollywood High. She had aspirations of being a stylist. She also learned how to be fancy, how to fancy herself up because of her mom's hair career. She knew beauty. She aspired to always be as beautiful as possible. Her mom told her she wouldn't make it as a stylist, though. That was a pipe dream. She said, focus on school. Focus on typing classes. Your best bet is becoming a secretary. But Lana wasn't interested. So she ditched school one day, a teenager at 15 at Hollywood High, and sat at a soda shop, sipping a soda, when she was approached by an agent asking her if she wanted to be in the pictures. She responded, I don't know. I'd have to ask my mom. Well, now, fortunately for Lana, her mom now believed in her bigger dreams. She didn't need to be a secretary. She could be a star. So Lana is introduced to one of the Marx brothers, Zeppo Marx, by way of the soda shop guy, Billy Wilkerson, who spotted her across the counter. Zeppo Marx had become a huge Hollywood agent, and she was going to begin her career through the Hollywood studio system, one in which aspiring actresses were given uppers to stay thin and to work long hours, and then downers to finally go to sleep at night. It was a sex-fueled predatory system, which, not unlike today, but seemingly worse back then, included young girls like Lana allegedly sleeping with the likes of future President Ronald Reagan when she was just 17 years old. Her first film, she played the victim of a murderer herself, a teenage girl raped and murdered in a small town. She was set up with a meeting with filmmaker Mervyn LeRoy regarding this role. And this would be the role that would land her the title Sweater Girl. A young girl about to be killed in a tight sweater bouncing across the screen. And she begins her very adult acting career. She became known as the Sweater Girl for that scene in the movie when she was just 16 bouncing down the street in the tight sweater. Men across the country gawked at the 16-year-old girl, and she was made a woman before she was even done finishing being a girl. But she was wholesome and cute, with a big smile. She was all things adorable and seductive, even if that's so incredibly inappropriate to say, but it was a different time, and she was proud of being seductive. So I don't feel so terrible saying that. I just think, you know. But that was the time, and that was the scenario the young girl found herself forced into. In this pattern, would repeat again and again, with her 8 marriages, but more tragic with her daughter. Generational trauma ran deep within this family. So, Mildred and Virgil, her dad, had been kind of on the outs at the time of his death, but for Lana, this was extremely difficult. She had worshipped her charming, handsome father, and that last gift she ever received from him, the bike. So it's possible that losing her father at such a young age led Lana to seek love in men. Many, many men. She was said to have affairs with many Hollywood men, including Howard Hughes, Frank Sinatra, Robert Stack, and obviously the marriages you'll come to hear about soon. In her book, she unabashedly also talks about her love of partying, which landed her the pet name, the Nightclub Queen. She said, quote, how I'd love to dress up and go dancing with a handsome, dark man, she writes. Ciro's was a favorite haunt. The head waiter would spring forward, ah, Miss Turner, and escort me in. I had a special table right by the stairs, so I could watch the comings and goings. I'd head straight there, never glancing right or left, and then when I was seated, I'd give the room a long casing, bowing to this one or blowing that one a kiss. Silly, I guess, but fun.
Film legend said she was discovered while skipping typing class. As one of Hollywood's most glamorous stars, her 7 husbands included jazzmen and millionaires. Howard Hughes was among her lovers. As a 30s pin-up, Lana Turner was nicknamed the Sweater Girl. MGM made her a star, despite an unsuccessful screen test for Gone with the Wind.
Why, you'd rather live with that stupid little fool who can't open her mouth except to say yes and no.
She was at her most seductive, plotting murder in The Postman Always Rings Twice.
But darling, can't you see how happy you and I would be together here? Without him.
So, Ceros came up last week in the Dating Game Killer episode, and I said I would tell a quick story about it. It was the most famous Hollywood nightclub, I mean, before my time, way before my time, on Sunset Strip, but then it became the Comedy Store, which I performed at hundreds, thousands, I don't even know how many times, but I remember, you know, like the club owners of the Comedy Store and then just like the other comedians, like the older ones that, you know, had been there for forever. You know, I'm trying to think of like, okay, so Mitzi Shore owned it. Why can't I think of the guy's name? He was the one that used to party with Mitzi. He may have even dated her. I can't remember. Polly Shore, you know, her son. You know, all the people, Jay Leto, you know, everyone. It's a famous Hollywood haunt. So anyways, I remember being told a story. So if you've never been to the Comedy Store before, there's the main room, which is like the big, huge, like three, you could seat like 300 something people. Then there's the original room, which is the one like right in the front, right off the Sunset Strip, that has all of like the names of the paid regulars, you know, like Jay Leno's name's up there and blah, blah, blah. Anyways, and then there's the belly room, which is upstairs of the Comedy Store. And that was actually originally made for women comics because it's the smallest room. It only seats like maybe, I don't know, 50 to 75 or something. But like us women comics weren't like super respected back in the day. I mean, I'm not sure we are now. I don't really know. But anyways, I was told at one point, so there's the belly room up there, upstairs. And then when you sit in the green room of the belly room, so before you go on stage, there's this like square sort of like trap door looking thing that like points towards the main room. And the main room must be where Lana's talking about, where she like saunters in and blows kisses or whatever, because that's like the most glamorous room. Anyways, I was told at one point where when I was waiting to go on stage that square thingamajiggy opened up to the main room, and that's where the mob bosses or the you know, the mafia, the guys operating around then, and the mob's going to come heavily into this story, very heavily. Mickey Cohen, Johnny Stampinato, who is kind of the main part of the murder in this story. But yeah, I was told that basically the mob would use that as like kind of like a sniper area. Like they would shoot guns down, and they would take people out from up above there. Who knows if that's totally true? I believe it though, because the Comedy Store was incredibly haunted. You can Google it. So that's the former Ceros. You know, there's stories of, because they used to also do like back alley abortions there, and there's stories of people that worked there later at the Comedy Store or whatever, who would feel like they were getting like smacked with a metal pipe in their knees when they would like go down to the basement, kind of like a mob killing type move, like break them at their knees. Anyways, that's just my little anecdote. And I apologize if I was breathing heavy there. I was like trying to hold in a burp. I've been eating. I made myself In-N-Out French fries, like homemade. And, wow. Could I be I should learn from Lana Turner. Like, be classier, Rachel. All right, moving on. So Lana went through several marriages, as we know. But the marriage that would result in Cheryl Crane's birth would be to Stephen Crane, a man that was an up-and-coming, but sort of like unsuccessful actor, who also, though, then went on to become a huge restaurateur, which I think is actually pretty cool. But the birth of Cheryl was very difficult because of Lana's specific blood type. And like Cheryl says in her book, that her life was almost immediately taken over with this whole tragedy. So to make matters worse, they were already kind of having a rough go in their relationship, but when she gets pregnant, They find out that she has Rh factor blood, which was incompatible with her daughter's blood. So Cheryl writes in her book, "My birth was a life and death struggle that swayed in the balance for nearly 2 months. That was me all over." But she was a miracle birth. And her dad also ended up getting out of the acting field and becoming a very, very successful restaurateur in the area. And it seems that Lana and him stayed, you know, close enough that she would show up to like the openings of his restaurant to, you know, get publicity and to, you know, make it better for him. And he would also stay in Cheryl's life. So, you know, it wasn't totally terrible. So what I find super interesting is, so I was like, okay, what restaurants did he end up owning? And then I Googled it and it said that Stephen Crane opened a string of Polynesian restaurants. And I was like, that is that Trader Vic's? Because that's like the famous one that's at the Beverly Hilton. And the famous one, and we're going to play the song for you. But he did not end up owning Trader Vic's, but he did open the Luau, a Polynesian-themed restaurant on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills, which became a celebrity hotspot, and I assume which Lana went to help him with the publicity. You know, it was known for its innovative tiki decor, high-profile customers, and Crane became well-known in the restaurant industry, and he even signed his menus as Stefuma High Talking Chief of the Luau. In an attempt to keep up with the storied personas of the Don the Beachcomber and Trader Vic. Trader Vic would be the more famous one that I was like, if he owned that, then this is like even more of a Hollywood story. But Trader Vic's at the Beverly Hilton is just a legendary, legendary restaurant. And even became a part of a song called Werewolves of London by Warren Zevon. I remember reading a long time ago that I saw a werewolf drinking a pina colada at Trader Vic's and his hair was perfect was about Jack Nicholson. I don't know. I'm not trying to start a rumor, but I'm trying to start a rumor. And Cheryl Crane was nicknamed the baby. She was immediately turned over to her nanny. She was coddled by the nanny and her mom, well, kind of not absentee necessarily, but she didn't actually spend any time alone with her daughter for the first year of her daughter. Lana goes on to have affairs with allegedly Clark Gable and a lot of Hollywood's top leading men, but the Clark Gable one is perhaps the most heartbreaking. She was co-starring with him in several films in the early 40s. And this is probably one of the more heartbreaking stories in this whole story. Well, there are several of them, but Robert Matson hypothesized in his book, Fireball, Carol Lombard and the Mystery of Flight 3. Basically, Lana Turner and Clark Gable had co-starred in several movies in the early 40s, and many women were very nervous when their husbands were co-starring with Lana. They just, I don't know, they saw her as some sort of seductress that could take their man at any time. And Carol Lombard, Clark Gable's wife, died on the Mystery Flight number 3. That Carol took that killed her, versus another safer plane that would have taken longer, and this was hypothesized in Robert Matson's book, Fireball, Carol Lombard and the Mystery Flight number 3. But she was so anxious to get home to Gable and to like intercept anything that could be happening with him and Lana Turner that she reportedly fought with the previous night about his affair with her and just rushed onto this flight and it would be her demise. It's just a weird, eerie Hollywood story. So meanwhile, Lana is able to have one healthy baby, but she did struggle with several miscarriages and a forced abortion. Her love life was not easy at all. But the worst of all was Lex. Lex Barker, a former Tarzan actor. He was her fourth husband, and he allegedly abused her daughter, Cheryl. and that abuse would almost lead to his murder. According to Cheryl, Lex first sexually abused her in the family sauna when she was only 10. In a dissociative shock, she heartbreakingly recalls waking up to her room after the attack. She said, "I pulled Raggedy Ann and a teddy bear from the toy truck and propped them beside me at a table, then set out tiny teacups. For a long while, late day, softened into twilight, we had a very nice tea party, chattered away all manner of tales, me and my friends." In horrific and vivid detail, she alleges that Lex violently raped her repeatedly throughout his marriage to her mother. And encouraged by her school friends, Cheryl finally told her mother, who immediately went home and held a gun to the sleeping Barker's head. Crane says that her mom immediately kicked him out. Immediately. She also took her to a doctor who said that the poor little girl had been so violently abused that she would have required stitches. But Lex doesn't really stop there. They ran into him at the parking lot of a store, and he grabbed onto the side of the vehicle, and her mother reacted in true film noir stealth and said, quote, "I'm pulling out of here, and if you don't let go, I will run you over." She waited, his eyes narrowed on me. With that, she hit the gas, dragging him along several feet until a grab of the brakes sent him tumbling to the asphalt. She said, "We sped away and he shrank to a tiny figure, dusting himself off, intently watching our flight." But sadly, this would be a very, very tragic time for little Cheryl. Because the times were just ignore everything. Her grandmother Mildred, her mom Lana, just said, "Put it out of your mind, let it go." Though they did try to protect her by getting rid of the scary man Lex, they just said, "Put it out of your mind." And then Cheryl began having problems like anyone would. She wasn't sent to therapy, you know, whatever. She attempted to run away at a certain point. She was sent to boarding school. On one of the runaways, she was picked up in Skid Row, thankfully, by a man that did not abuse her and actually brought her to the police station. But her life was just fraught with tragedy for a long time after that. I will say she did go on to become an accomplished author. I really wanted to get in touch with her for this episode, but I don't have to cold call everyone. I do that too much. So I just want to tell her story in the, you know, most proper way possible. And I should have said trigger warning, by the way, for that violent thing that happened to her. One would think, though, that her mom, Lana, would maybe slow down on the dating or the marrying at this point after the horrible thing that happened to her daughter, but she doesn't, and she gets involved with a mob-connected man named Johnny Stompinato, a crony of Mickey Cohen, one that she likely met at Ciro's nightclub. After the marriage to Lex, so you have to think, Cheryl is literally still reeling from the abuse she suffered at the hands of her mother's former husband. And now her new boy toy, along with several other abusive husbands Lana's had in the past, Cheryl has seen this stuff constantly. Abuse towards her mother, obviously towards her. She's primed and ready to react. So when Johnny Stompinato enters the picture, a low-level gangster, associate of Mickey Cohen, likely Lana met at Ciro's, which was a huge gangster haunt, Johnny begins kind of to rough Lana up, especially when she tries to leave him. He even shows up on set on a film that she's filming with Sean Connery all the way in London, and Sean Connery has to get involved and gets in a fight with Johnny in a way to get him away from Lana. But then, the night of the Oscars, it all escalates. Lana is nominated, but she does not win, but still, it's a beautiful night. Lana, her mother, her daughter Cheryl, all dressed so beautifully, having the most wonderful night. Cheryl dances with Sean Connery, and Sean looks across the room and says to Cheryl, looking at Lana, "Now that's a star." Meanwhile, something else was brewing behind the scenes. Johnny Stompanato was not going to let Lana go. There are rumors that the relationship between Lana and Johnny were all set up by the mob anyways. Maybe there was nothing even romantic there. But regardless, it's just another chapter in the tumultuous relationships of Lana Turner and men. The relationship with Johnny and Lana was stormy. It was punctuated with frequent arguments and fights. In 1957, Stompanato became so jealous about Turner's relationship with future James Bond actor Sean Connery, he flew to London and traveled to Hertfordshire. He stormed onto the set of Another Time, Another Place, threatening Connery with a gun. Undeterred, the 6'2" actor, who was a former bodybuilder and karate black belt, bent Stompanato's backhand, forcing him to drop the weapon. Stompanato was reported to the police and quietly deported from the United Kingdom. After Johnny's death, it was rumored that at least one LA mobster held Connery responsible, leading the actor to go into hiding for a short time afterwards. But Connery would not be the one who killed Johnny Stompanato. On April 4th, 1958, Johnny Stompanato was stabbed to death by Turner's teenage daughter, Cheryl Crane, at her mother's home in Beverly Hills, California. She claimed that Stompanato had been violently attacking her mother. A coroner's inquest returned a decision of justifiable homicide. After ruling, Stompanato's family sued Turner for $750,000, $6 million today. They later settled for $20,000, $154,000 a day. He ended up being buried in Illinois beside his mother. Cheryl Crane went on to become an accomplished author and a very, very good person. She was likely rattled from her former abuse from her mother's former husband, Lex, and seeing her mom's active abuse constantly from man after man, that she felt such fear that she attacked Johnny Stompanato, an alleged gangster. Which is pretty crazy for a 14-year-old to do. Pretty damn bold. But she ended up a classy woman later in life. But this linked her mom and her to gossip columns for the rest of their lives. It's a time that they call the paragraph. In Cheryl's book, she said, "Here we sat in our golden couch, the three Turner girls, all gowned, coiffed, and lacquered to death. Carefully, we held in our bottoms so as not to wrinkle the dresses, just the way we held in our thoughts so as not to let out real feelings. You see, even when we were together, we were still alone. In this family, souls never touched." It was Oscar night, March 26, 1958. Turner, along with her daughter and mother, were on their way to the 30th Annual Academy Awards at the Pantages Theater. Though Turner lost Best Actress, she'd been nominated for the role in Peyton Place, her daughter was in awe. At the Oscar ball later that night, 14-year-old Crane finished dancing with Sean Connery, who was also in trance. "Cheryl, love, look over there at your mom. That's what I call a star." When it comes to what happened on the night of April 4th, 1958, Crane and Turner's stories are perfectly aligned. Turner says she attempted to break things off once and for all, and Johnny then went crazy, threatening to destroy her face and harm her mother and child. As the fight escalated, a frantic Cheryl, who had been drawn into the drama by her mother, listened at the door as the abuse continued. She ran downstairs and grabbed a knife before running back upstairs where the screaming continues. She writes, "I picked the knife up from the floor. The door flew open. Mother stood there, her hand on the knob. He was coming at her from behind, his arm raised to strike. I took a step forward and lifted the weapon. He ran on the blade. I went in. For three ghastly heartbeats, our bodies fused. He looked straight at me, unblinking. My God, Cheryl, what have you done?" Mm-hmm. The rest of that experience was pop-pop of flashbulbs, crackling of daylight, police radios, reporters, and her dad sliding her into a police car and going off to the Beverly Hills police station. She felt like an animal in a zoo. Her parents fought for her daughter's release. At the inquest, Turner, whose life had been ruled by publicity for 2 decades, gave the performance of her life. She writes, "It was a humiliating ordeal to explain on the witness stand what I barely understood myself. To confess before the cameras that strange helplessness that bound me to John for so long. More than once, I nearly broke down on the witness stand from the mixture of agony and shame, of grief and relief that I felt about John's death, but all of my emotions were secondary compared to Cheryl's release. That's what was mattered now." The killing was ruled a justifiable homicide, but while Turner's career continued to soar thanks to her casting in films like Imitation of Life, Cheryl, racked with guilt and anger, justifiably blamed her mother for her new infamy. "Considering all she and I had just been through, I suppose our relationship was destined to be like gasoline and matches. I wanted to defy anything she stood for." But Cheryl Crane would end up being a success in life. A very sweet girl who went through so many things, who ended up in a psychiatric hospital where a fellow patient, the comedian Jonathan Winters, told her, "As long as we keep laughing, they can't get us." And that's where we will end today's episode. As long as we keep laughing, they can't get us. As long as we keep laughing, they can't get us. I love you guys so much. Merry Christmas. I think this will be the Christmas episode. Not sure, but I got some good shit planned for you for the next episode. The next episode's sort of a surprise, interesting format, but I love you guys. Merry Christmas. Thank you so much. You're always the best. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Good night.